Essay 4. I love the late October leaf fall. A day like today. The light so bright, quartz clean, every detail in high relief. The sky a satiny blue veneer, as if the deep azure of summer has been washed out a few times. Halfway now toward the almost whites of winter, the air perfectly still, except for the slight waterfall-like flow of the cold air pouring slowly straight down over my face. Just enough weight, without the wind, to keep a steady smattering of leaves, 6 or 8 of them always in the air around me, floating leisurely about on their way back down to the ground. Each still glossy with the first hard frost, half wet, half shimmering, with melting flecks. Today, I took a path that heads up the steep wooded hill, my favorite one, especially this time of year. The first full layer of leaves already down, a rag rug of red, yellow, brown, obscuring the path, so you have to know how it goes to stay on it. All the knowledge of past walks automatically kicking in to keep you on course going forward. Near the top of the incline, I turned around to look back. The staccato of separate leaves clicking as they hit the ground. I remembered a poem I wrote 30-some years ago about another looking-back moment on a similar walk in another time and place in my life. The closing poem of a series called Autumn Walks to Work. I have lost just about everything I can think of, at least once in this town. One night, firestorms afloat on a foam of smoke smelting. By morning, nothing but empty shells of mills, tame as sheep asleep on their feet. Raucous autumn, I walk across broad yellow pools of dead leaves, my gait steady, geared, it seems, to a dream of my own making. A shutter clicks, fixing in black and white the empty frames of trees, the leaf-strewn hill, and me. Grateful the fallings are all over this fierce season at the brink. Glancing back, almost halfway home. Back then, I was trying to come to terms with a different kind of loss and the echoing difficulties that inevitably follow from the first big one, before the space is fully cleared for what's next. It was a moment of insight, full of resolve and hope, a fine brew for a young man to savor for a moment, as the calendar of life made a decisive seasonal turn toward a new, imagined, but unrealized yet, home. I am, of course, now way more than halfway home, though I'm not sure any longer what home actually is, if it even exists for me, in this world or the next. Today I look down the hill through the perfectly clear air, all the way back to where I started. I watch the leaves twirling down, all about to merge into the raw detritus of autumn. Some big, some small, all disconnected until they get back together on the ground. How fleetingly delicate each seemed. None, either again, or a loss, just a brief fluttering, then, now, gone. I turned and headed up toward the hilltop, and in front of me, the same seed playing out, leaf after leaf, cascading absently, as far forward as I could see. I could unravel some elaborate analogy here, but I don't want to. I don't want you to do it either. Just picture what I saw. That is all there is, and enough. As I hit the apex, I started to laugh. Rowdy, deep, complex belly laughs, for no reason in particular, or at all. It just came out, as it has quite often on these walks over the last 2 months or so. I'm walking along, laughing, apparently hysterically, if anyone happened to encounter me, which has happened only a couple of times, like I'm off my rocker. It is, as I said, a complex laugh, full of joy and sadness, all of a piece. Sometimes I find myself crying that way, full of joy and sadness, all of a piece. Sometimes it's hard to tell which is which. We tend to think of those things, joy and sadness, laughing and crying, past and future, life and death, as polar opposites, that it would take arduous, day-long slogs to make it all the way from one to another. They're not, at least not for me lately. They're right on top of each other, indivisible, together in every step, like sunlight flickering on and off over the surface of each leaf as it twists and turns on its way down. The leaf inscribes the boundaries of the light just as much as the light delineates the space of the leaf. That is what I am laughing at. Exactly. Just that. About halfway down the other side of the hill, I encounter, literally encounter, am stopped by, the laid-out trunk of a long, downed tree, sunk ankle-deep in the grass, askance to the path. It has been there, I'd say, by the state of its decay at least 10 years, so I've walked by it now hundreds of times without ever noticing it. The landscape in that part of the park is littered with such logs, angled akimbo in this direction or that. I stopped to look at it, to try to figure out why it became noticeable to me, intimately so, today. Its rounded top surfaces were laden with a layer of lime-green moss, shaggy, happy-looking, iridescent in the bright light trickling in like poured ice cream toppings, spread out flowingly on its way down over the curvy, cold surface until it finally freezes in place. Maybe it was the disjunction between all this falling, the leaves around me, the log long ago having fallen, all of it, and that eruption of thick, mossy green, life intruding, as it always does, undeterred. Again, I don't want to push so much on this that it gets buggy. Better to leave it enigmatic. A dead log on the ground, a froth of moss. I've actually been thinking a lot this week about enigmas, about Emily Dickinson in particular, the enigmas that are her poems, the enigma that she was while she was here. We were reading her work in my graduate seminar. At the end of class, when I was kind of tired and more apt to ramble, I went off on a jag about how, both culturally and academically, we too often deploy the discourse of abnormality, psychological, social, sexual, whatever, in relation to great artists, putatively as a way of explaining how they could produce the works that then produce the great or strange effects we read them for. The older I get, the more offended I am by this. I see it as a way to diminish, distance, even discredit their force, their beauty, separate them from us categorically, disparagingly, in a backhanded way, with names like bipolar, neurotic, even schizophrenic, all modern inventions, by the way, as if this allows us both to indulge in and protect ourselves from, via our imagined normalcy, what art has to offer. Emily Dickinson is a good example. I've been reading her poems on and off for over 50 years now. I liked them on day one in the American Poets Anthology I bought in the 7th grade, and I like them still. Whenever I teach the poems, student after student, taking us to one of their favorites, will say, "I really enjoyed this poem, but I can't figure it out," or "I'm not sure what she means," or "I don't understand it," or some other variation of the same response. I've taken lately to asking them, does that make you want to just put it down and never read it again? A perfectly legitimate, even appropriate, readerly response to texts that resist comprehension. Or to come back to it over and over. They all say the latter, just like I have for 50 years now. But there has always been an edge there for me, a barrier I couldn't quite seem to climb over, something that kept me, I knew, from fully getting the poems. But why? I could never pin it down exactly. It was not, I knew, because they were enigmatic. So was Crane, Hopkins, roughly contemporaneous. I got them. Maybe it was gender, I kept thinking. Maybe. I suspect that when I read her for the first time, found out a bit about her, I simply embraced the then-standard stereotype. She was a fidgety, staid, hair in a bun, old maidish recluse, gliding silently around in her father's oppressive New England house like a tight, tidy ghost, writing her cryptic little poems and sticking them in a drawer. Kind of weird, fearful maybe, afflicted by what we now so churlishly call a social anxiety disorder. But still compellingly deep and sometimes scary, both of which I liked. I came to understand also fairly quickly that some kindly, influential man helped her family get the poems published after she died. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, that is, who was, for some time thereafter, lionized, an honored, even heroic figure, the one who single-handedly salvaged this great work from the dustbin of her desk. I read her work again from time to time through the 70s and 80s, while feminist wave after feminist wave took legitimate issue with this characterization of Higginson, often flogging him mercilessly and deservedly for his obsession with punctuation and word order, his veritable translation of her distinctive, eccentric style into the preferred poetic vernacular of his moment. As if she were some unschooled basic writer whose errors needed to be corrected. At some point, maybe in the late 80s or early 90s, I looked into their relationship a little further, read the letter to a young contributor that Higginson published in The Atlantic in 1862. His combination of a call to arms for new young American writers and a compendium of hard-bitten advice about what to do and avoid if you want to get published in a highly competitive literary marketplace, which was what seemed to have instigated Dickinson's first epistolary contact with him. Then his long article in The Atlantic in 1891 after her death, the book of her poems he edited, having found a more favorable reception than he expected, inciting him to recount, self-interestedly, his long history of correspondence with this now genius. But I read him then in the same limited way, through a feminist lens, as self-absorbed, arrogant, kind of oafish, basking in her fame after her death, a well-connected, influential man in a man's world. Yes, all of that. But I was no further along in my efforts to crack her code than she was in her efforts to crack his, or at least the one he stood for, synecdochically. This week, though, because my theme was abnormality as a mode of control, a conversation I started when we talked about Coleridge and Whitman, who tend to be subjected to the same sort of patronizing dismissals, again, via the routine discourse of abnormal psychology, I decided to go back and read the Higginson texts again, and, as it happened, with different eyes. One of the organizing concepts for our discussions in the seminar is gender, as in how it pertains specifically to the material we're reading. I realized when I sat down to look at these materials again that for the last 30 years or so, I've been trying to encounter Dickinson through the figurative lens of feminism. And I was about to do that again. Then I thought about it. One of the symptoms of this approach was my tendency to try to read her work with my ultimate hope of finally getting it, as if I were a woman in the latter half of the 19th century, as much a man's literary world as you'd find, well, forever up until then. This, I thought, is just a stupid way for me to read. I am not a woman, period. What would ever make me think I could read that way? What I just spontaneously decided to do instead was to read her, both the poetry and especially the correspondence with Higginson, as if I were a man, but one trying to make a way and a name for myself in a culture that had been dominated by women for 2,500 years. What, I thought, would I do if poetry and poetics had been rendered for all that time via whatever might be the feminine translation of Shelley's Sword of Lightning ever unsheathed? I reread the opening of her first letter to Higginson. Mr. Higginson, are you too deeply occupied to say if my verse is alive? The mind is so near itself it cannot see distinctly, and I have none to ask. Should you think it breathed, and had you the leisure to tell me, I should feel quick gratitude. If I make the mistake that you dared to tell me would give me sincere honor toward you, I enclose my name, asking you, if you please, sir, to tell me what is true. that you will not betray me, it is needless to ask, since honor is its own pawn. Wow, what a fantastic way to declare yourself. So confident, no deer crap in the salutation. So clever, indexing some of the very things he talked about in his article. So elusive, slippery, as if the meaning is tantalizingly just beyond grasp, inviting, no, almost requiring, a response from someone like him who would feel compelled to pin those things down. The poems she sent him were also all of that and more. It is, I thought, masterful, and exactly what I would say and how I would say it as a man were I in her cultural position. So I thought further, gender is not the key here. What then is it? Then it hit me. It is temperament. I would write that way from my position as an outsider looking to get in, not because I felt subordinate, deferential, but because I was reclusive. The source and reservoir of my power and many of my problems in this world. Like her, just like her. Yes, that was it. And as soon as I saw that, everything opened up. I got her. Get her, finally. The thing that the normative majority, whatever binary imbalance you want to fill that in with, doesn't realize is that the non-normative minority understands them much better than they even understand themselves. I demonstrate this through my actual experience with a reclusive temperament in a gregarious world. As a child, I hated to be in front of, noticed by others. I hated even to be looked at. I hated to talk, and I didn't, unless I absolutely had to. I would sit for long stretches in the company of others, quiet, listening, and when asked a question, I'd respond briefly, deflectively. I could go on. If you're a reclusive, you know. If you're not, it doesn't matter. My point is this. I realized at some point that in order to survive in the normative social universe, I mean like get and keep a job, I would have to learn how to behave normally. So I set to that task. I taught myself first how to tolerate being looked at, then how to stand up in front of others, then to speak up in front of others, then to sound smart when I spoke, etc. It's a long list of skills you have to teach yourself if you're not born with them, believe me. And it takes a lot of hard work and a long time. By this means, I became not only socially proficient, but quite knowledgeable about what's involved in acquiring that proficiency. I could do it, but I could also teach it. Like every other quality, we say people come born with, not made well, it's not that. In some ways, I might say, because of how I came by these traits, I'm actually better at them than those who were endowed with them naturally. On the opposite side, my sense is that socially normative people have little to no clue what makes people like me and Emily Dickinson go and tick. I say this because I often hear at either first or second hand the things that people say to interpret my demeanor or behavior. Their explanations account for every detail in a meticulous and logical way. I would, if I chose to, have no way to refute them or even begin to dissuade someone of their accuracy. Yet they are absolutely wrong. The real me and my perfectly accurate way of accounting for him are on a parallel path that will never intersect with those versions of me dancing around in other heads. Never. So this week, that became my common ground with Emily Dickinson. Just by happenstance, the first poem someone picked to talk about in class was her famous Nobody poem. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public. Like a frog. To tell one's name, the livelong June, to an admiring bog. One commentator felt sorry for her that she would have to think of herself as a nobody, a terrible fate for such a gifted writer. But that's not at all what I hear in that poem now. A nobody, for a recluse, is not, of course, a somebody, but a nobody is not a nothing. A nobody is, in fact, the ultimate something, exactly what you don't want to let others get a hold on. Otherwise, they'd advertise, not that. And then, Stanza two, well, you can see where that goes yourself. To generalize, then, I'd say that the best way to establish a bond of understanding with whatever side of the cultural equation happens to be weaker is to look at it via an equation in which you happen to be weaker. And what I discovered this week was the potential power of my non-normative temperament. That's my now new connection with Emily Dickinson. When I read her letters this time, I heard her over and over, not seeking his petty commentary by return post, not deferring to his story, but asking Higginson straight up to take a chance with her work, stand up for it, walk into some publisher's office, which he could have done and she couldn't have, and say, here it is, what I was calling for in my article, let's run with it. But he doesn't. He won't. Over and over he won't. For 20-some years he won't. And reading his readings of her letters in the article he wrote after her death and remembering the article he wrote to incite her first foray into his world, I could see why. It had nothing to do with gender. It was because she was reclusive, and no matter how hard he pushed, tell me who you are, send me a picture, I'd better come up to Amherst to meet you, she wouldn't give up what he wanted or give in to his prying, his need to pin her down so he could advertise her. As I read through her letters this time, I found myself laughing over and over at her deft brilliance, her parries to his jabs, the substance or impact of which has to be adduced from her subsequent responses to him, since his letters to her were lost, meaning to me she destroyed them, which, for a recluse, has significance. But she doesn't ever give him what he's asking for. He keeps coming on. She keeps floating, stinging, rope-a-doping. It's brilliant. Had she approached him the first time in a socially normative way, he would never have responded even once. She was able to keep him on the hook for 20 years. Part of it, of course, was she was a great poet. But if that were enough for him, he would have jumped to publish immediately the work of what he claims he recognized at the first reading of her four original submissions to him as that of a wholly new and original poetic genius. His refusal to do that, which he accounts for in a doofusy sounding explanation about the works being elusive to criticism, was his way of keeping her on the hook for 20-some years. And the key to me on both sides of this fight forever to a draw is her signature mark, the dash. Oddly, before Higginson ever saw her work, he commented specifically in his article on how poets should avoid eccentric punctuation, and he made a particular point about the dash, as in, don't use it. I honestly think that if Dickinson had just stopped sending in poems with dashes in them, he may have pushed her work toward publication. But that is exactly the thing she would never be willing to give up, as anyone with reclusive tendencies would know. Not that reclusive people like dashes, just that they have certain small stylistic preferences that happen for them to be self-defining, important, key. Take them away, and the rest falls apart. Simple as that. That is, I now believe, why they were at loggerheads. And also, why Higginson was willing to edit her poems toward publication only after she died. Then he could, among other things, get rid of those pesky dashes. And he did. You can see this same dynamic echoed in the equally dysfunctional relationship between Anne Sexton and James Dickey in the 1960s. Sexton was, I heard then, though I never saw her in person, and have read since, quite stylish, dramatic, glamorous, exuding a sexual energy of the sort that was possible in the 1960s, in a way it would never have been for Emily Dickinson, even if she was inclined that way, which I'm not willing to say with complete confidence that she was not. I actually think now she would have been aghast to get to know. Anyway, Dickey was brash, confident, Hemingway-esque in his masculinity, sexually aggressive, and inclined to affairs with the women to whom he was attracted. I didn't know back then, but have read since that he made a move on Sexton and was, not surprisingly, rebuffed. The 1960s were not the 1860s. She didn't need anything from him to get ahead. What I did know back then was how rude and stupid his reviews of her work were, the first two of her books especially. He was particularly incensed by her references to female body parts and functions, which he found pathetic and disgusting. I remember having arguments with others about whether he was a good poet or just a big tool, to borrow a pretty useful word from the lexicon of that moment, an argument that history has settled in the meantime in favor of the latter. I bring this up here because Dickey made his money in the advertising business. He was, in other words, a big frog in the socially normative bog. He was also, you might be surprised to know, quite a prominent poet at that time. Widely published, deferred to in literary circles, a force. I say surprise for a reason. His poetry was as packaged as his prose, but it had an air about it that appealed to the marketplace of the moment. I asked my class last week, for example, who had heard of and read some of the work of Anne Sexton. Everyone had. I asked them who had heard of and read some of the work of James Dickey. None of them had. He is actually, as best I can tell, more famous now for his ridiculous assault on Sexton's femaleness than for his own work. Same I'd say for Higginson. Nobody now would have heard of him, be writing about him, or cared at all what he said in 1862 about how to get published if it hadn't been for Emily Dickinson. I could go on and on about all of this, the kind of ragged rant I often devolve toward at the end of a long class. Suffice it to say that once I came to this insight about Dickinson, I felt like one of those old adding machines after you've punched in all the numbers, then pressed total, and the paper would just fly up off its roll printing while you watched and waited, calculating everything all at once. That's how I got Emily Dickinson. I plan to reread all of her poems this winter and laugh and puzzle and cry with her. We are finally two of a kind. I narrated a truncated version of this for the class, but I had another point to make with it. Higginson could have and should have gotten her poems published when she was 31. She would have loved it, I'm sure of that. Her life would have been happier and better, no matter the din of the admiring bog. He didn't. He waited until she was dead and could make all of his corrections on behalf of his hard-nosed cultural marketplace. He added a dismissive preface to cover his ass, too. Here's what I told my class. Most people who come and ask you for things, well, if you say you can't do it, they go to the next person and the next. They always have a backup plan. Every now and then, though, you will encounter someone for whom you are the only plan. If you say no, or just dodge it because it seems a little risky or they seem a little weird, it will not get done. Ever. Maybe it shouldn't, but maybe it should. Emily Dickinson is a good example. Think about it. Don't wait until somebody like her, whom you could have stood up for, is dead, and it's safe for you to do what you want to do for posterity. Higginson may have done us a favor by conserving Emily Dickinson's poems for us to read in all these classrooms. But he did nothing for her. Nothing. He could have changed her life. He could have made her happy, even famous. All he did for her while she was alive is pester her and string her along. Shame on him. Shame on anyone and everyone who withholds the good they can do for the living because of anything. Don't do that, I told my class. Don't do that. Do not do that.